Quaker, Bravo Lima 5, Papa Zulu.
They
see
the door, they turn the key.
Okay, on the northbound access. Just right at the light.
Look, I think, what's the altitude? And I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on a donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good to be back here in the studio. Good old Studio 4. I'm here with my good friend, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, it's, you know, Aaron has a Big Dumb Fun Show that he does every Monday night. And so go to the BigDumbFunShow.com homepage and listen in to his, it's a drive time.
Trending talk radio, independent unsigned music, local music artist.
Thanks, Aaron.
We use the studio for other things as well. Obviously,
right.
Gangland Wire.
Right.
And crime stories. And then on Sunday nights, we've been doing a thing called Sarcasm Cinema, where we make fun of films.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And if you would want to rent the studio and have Aaron run the soundboard and do your own recording of some kind, why, he has a rate card that he can work with you and do a recording with you. You know, we've been talking about Nick Civella and Chicago Mob, and we're going to continue down this Chicago Mob path. I have gotten on some Facebook Chicago mob pages, and there's a huge interest in the mob in Chicago and the connection to Kansas City, and mainly because of the movie Casino and the skim operation that those guys joined together to take the skim out of Las Vegas. You know, Lefty Rosenthal, the Robert De Niro character's real name was Lefty Rosenthal. He was a Chicago guy, and Joe Pesci's character, Tony Spilotro, who was a Chicago guy. Tony Spilotro had something to do with the skim, but he really didn't. He had his own action going out there, and he maybe would intimidate somebody that Lefty wanted intimidated, but primarily to run the skim and make sure it was run right. If anybody started messing up the skim, then it was Kansas City's job to straighten that out. They were a lot more sophisticated than Tony Spilotro and Nick Civella particularly was. And you, if you've listened to the last three episodes, you know that Nick Civella was a pretty sophisticated, cunning, bright, intelligent mob boss. And so, but he had this, if you remember, we talked about 22, a guy they called 22 on the wires, and that was the mob boss in Chicago. It was kind of Nick Civella's counterpart, shall we say, in Chicago, and his name was Joseph Iupa. He went by the moniker Joey Doves. You know, Nick Civella didn't have a moniker. Did you ever notice that, Aaron?
I never noticed
It's just Nick. Yeah, his real name is Nicholas.
And they would call him Nick.
And we just get everybody calls him Nick. There's no cutesy little nickname like Joey Doves or Corky or Tuffy or anything like that. You know, go figure.
Do you think that was out of respect or just?
You know, I think he just never got hung with a moniker.
Some guys
at work would be get hung with a moniker depending on something they'd done or some way they looked, and other people wouldn't. And probably he was probably not the kind of guy that you could joke around with, maybe.
He was pretty serious,
and nobody really ever had the courage to if they gave him a nickname or a moniker, they never said it to his face. He probably let people know they didn't like it. But anyhow.
Well, I would think, you know, in your position over the years doing surveillance, maybe you would come to know if he did have a nickname.
Oh, yeah. We would have known. Law enforcement would have known if he had a nickname, and we never heard one. Oh, Zio. Now, they called him Zio. Tuffy called him Zio to certain people, and everybody knew that meant Nick. And Zio is Italian or Sicilian for uncle. So I guess Uncle Nick. If he had any moniker, it was Zio, which means uncle. Let's start talking about Joey Iupa. If you remember, Nick was a little worried. He wanted to call Lefty Rosenthal out in Las Vegas because Lefty was creating a lot of stir and creating a lot of attention, law enforcement attention and newspaper attention, press attention, and gaming commission attention. And they knew if he got in too much trouble, they could start looking closer at what he'd been doing at casino. And he really needed to just get out. And he was fighting tooth and nail to hang on to his job in the casino.
Wasn't there already heat kind of brought on by the fact that Lefty Rosenthal was just so
I don't say flamboyant.
He was so flamboyant, yeah.
He was so out in front and so arrogant to believe that no one could tell him different, including the Gaming Commission, which just drew them in harder to look at what was going on.
Correct. You know who the, was it the president, the chairman of the Gaming Commission was at that time? It was Harry Reid, Senator Harry Reid. He was a young guy who was just on his way up in politics. And matter of fact, they had a name for him in the wires. They called him Clean Face. Some people thought he might be dirty, but I've went over the wiretap transcripts and found all the references to Clean Face, and I found nothing. I found nothing that indicated he was dirty at all. They thought they might be able to work with him, but it seemed like they're more talking about it in a political way. If they didn't create too much heat, then maybe he'd back off. But yeah. he was the chairman of the Gaming Commission, and Lefty was in his face. There's in my movie, there's a scene that I got from a news program of Lefty right in Harry Reid's face, saying that this was a used foul language and said that they were, this was a Western vigilante justice, that they were, he was a good solid businessman and they were just trying to run him out of town. And
well, they were.
And they were, yeah.
But mostly maybe because he'd been there for some time operating under the radar.
Yeah. He'd never had a license because he's a convicted felon.
He couldn't have a license.
So what he did, he was a food and beverage manager. And then when they got on him on that, he just changed his title. And when he got him on that and told him he had to stay out of the casino, he just ran the casino from his home via the telephone. So, you know, he just would not give up. And so anyhow, Nick wanted to call him, and he was worried about offending IUPA if he should call him directly. Because, you know, in that world, Lefty Rosenthal was owned by IUPA and the Chicago mob. And it's like on the police department, if I'm a sergeant and I have a squad of six guys, or I'm a captain and I have two or three squads of 15 guys, 20 guys and gals, I guess, today. And one of them does something that offends somebody in another unit, then nobody from that unit, no captain or major or sergeant, can come directly to my person and speak to them about it. They have to come to me, to the boss of that person. You don't go directly to a subordinate that's not your subordinate. You have to go to their boss, and the mafia's the same way.
Same way.
So
I mean, this is kind of unprecedented for Nick Civella to just...
Right. And if you remember, he and Tuffy kind of worked that out between themselves, that it was probably okay as long as he was diplomatic, and he was. He was real diplomatic, and he talked to him, and he didn't offend IUPA. But let's talk about IUPA. He's a really interesting guy. He was the last one to die of the old Capone gangsters. He came up under the Al Capone regime in the 30s. And
as part of the Chicago
20s
outfit.
The Chicago mob. He was born in 1907. He has a similar... upbringing as Nick. He got in trouble as a youth. He left school at age 11, and by 1922 he was working as a gardener in a greenhouse. And that's kind of weird. I don't know what the deal is, because he was a young thug. But shortly thereafter, 1925, this is all from his prison records, he's said he's a driver at Midwest Cartage Company in Chicago, which, you know, now being a truck driver, that's a little more in line with being a mob guy. But by 1930, the FBI records show that he had purchased the Turf Lounge at 4831 West Cermak in Cicero. Now, Cicero, you know, that was historically, that's Al Capone territory. And that's one way you know right off the bat that if he owned a Turf Lounge in Cicero, Illinois in 1930, he was a Capone guy.
Now, where is Cicero in relationship to Chicago?
It's west of downtown, due west of downtown, like right in the middle of downtown. You just start going west and it will be one of the first suburban
cities
that had been a city but is now part of Chicago itself.
Now, is that in your app?
You know, no, it's not. There is an app on that. Maybe if I ever get around to expanding my app to Chicago. Now, it's a parking lot today. I did look it up on Google Maps. It's just a parking lot today.
Because you had shared through your app, I thought, that map of Chicago, or you tweeted that out.
You know, I did. I put that's on my website. I didn't put that in my app, but that'd be a link to that Chicago Syndicate website that has the Chicago map with Chicago sites. So there is a place you guys can go out there to the Chicago Syndicate. It's a really good mob blog, and it has a one page that has a good Chicago map, just like my blog now has a page that has
a map with all these map. Pins on it. And you can zoom in.
Right.
Can you change? You can change the view to satellite too, can't you?
You can. You can change the satellite and see exactly what it looks like today.
You
it's
don't
pretty
have to
slick.
Knock on their door. You could just look down their chimney.
Right. It's pretty slick. I did that a lot when I was doing this about see if these some of these places were still there. But anyhow, that's, you know, we got him up to 1930, and he also, during the 30s, he becomes part owner of the Taylor Company, and the Taylor Company was described as a gaming equipment manufacturer. He seems to be kind of hung up on gaming, because also during the 1930s, one of his first arrests was Cook County, and the state's attorney's office said reported that they arrested several people, one of whom was Joseph Iupa, for the robbery of golf clubs. Now, and I don't mean a country club. And I think what they were doing was probably, you know, country clubs have historically had high stakes card games. Mm-hmm. And so he's probably going around robbing gambling games more than likely.
And they couldn't say that, so they just said
that robbing golf clubs, robbing golf clubs, but it was gambling clubs. Now, there was an FBI report that I got my hands on. It shows that it's more like an intelligence report. It didn't really talk about what kind of a crime he committed, because it wasn't a federal crime. But they have a source that said during this arrest, he was treated like a common criminal until he was asked who he's worked for. And he said, you know, I work for Johnny Moore. Well, Johnny Moore was a Al Capone associate whose real name was Claude Maddox and was a co-owner with Iupa of the Taylor Gaming Equipment Company. So immediately he was released. They treated the FBI reports that all of a sudden he was treated with respect and was released shortly thereafter.
Because it was a legitimate gaming company.
Well, it probably was, although they, as I checked into it, they did have, there were other gaming equipment companies that complained that these guys seemed to have a monopoly. These guys
kind of had a monopoly on the market.
These guys had a monopoly on the market. Exactly. And you know how mob owned company gets a monopoly on the market. So in 1930s, as both of these guys, he got married in Melrose Park, Illinois, and that's where he lived. He got married at a church by a priest, Father Benjamin French, of 1103 23rd Avenue, and you know that church is still there. It's Our Lady of Mount Carmel Parish. He and his wife and his mother all lived together in Melrose Park at 910 22th Avenue, and
is that structure still standing?
That's a Family Dollar store today. That's thank God for Google Maps. It kind of made this more interesting to do.
Because you could actually add that into the app someday.
I could.
You wouldn't worry if somebody went and knocked on the door of the Family Dollar. Yeah. It'd be no big deal.
Yep.
They should actually maybe sell little mementos of
they should.
Little doves.
Now, you know, as I was researching his background, and I get a pretty good FBI file on him. One of the early entries said he was connected to John Dillinger, Ma Barker, and Creepy Carpus gang. He was connected to the Ma Barker and Alvin Creepy Carpus gang, who was always connected to
John Dillinger
and Babyface Nelson, all those 1930s bank robbers that went up and down in the Midwest. Terrence O'Malley, when he did the podcast on the Union Station Massacre, he talked a lot about this. So I thought, well, that's interesting. How did that come about? And I started researching into John Dillinger around this time. And you know, one of the earlier entries when I find him connected to Chicago organized crime people was a particular situation close to Chicago in late 20s, probably just before the crash. There was a guy named Emil Wantka who bought some land and built a lodge up in Manitowash Waters, Wisconsin, just north of Chicago, and it would become a getaway for people out of Chicago, of course, and it was called Little Bohemia Lodge, located off of Highway 51, and I think it's still there today. But his lawyer, Mr. Wanatka's lawyer, was from Chicago, and his name was Louis Piquet. And he was connected to mob people, and he also had represented John Dillinger.
Publicly known that this was the guy that was representing John Dillinger.
Right, this was publicly known back then.
Enemy number one, wasn't he?
Well, probably at this point in time. He was
29.
He was up in the upper tens, probably. Anyhow, so that kind of shows that the owner of this lodge may not be a totally innocent party in this. And so Dillinger wanted to lay low with his gang. He had a gang going. It wasn't Ma Barker or Alvin Karpus, but it did have some other well-known Midwest bank robbers, one of whom was Babyface Nelson. The intelligence reports at the time said that Paquette had arranged hideouts for several outlaws, and he even arranged for plastic surgery later for Dillinger by a Chicago mob doctor named Dr. Wilhelm Loser. I mean, you can't write this stuff.
This is actually from the reports.
This is from the FBI reports and another book on this. So,
well, wait, if Dillinger has to be paying Paquette,
all right,
he paid
him pretty good.
And if it's known that he's the attorney, why? I mean, Dillinger was on the lam at that point.
He was on the lam. Yes, he was wanted man. Everybody in his party was wanted.
He wasn't out on bail, and they were going to arrange someplace for you to stay.
No, he was wanted. He was laying low. He was hiding out, and he actually paid $500 rent for his outfit to stay 3 days at this little Bohemia lounge, which I checked into that, and that would be about like $5,000 to $6,000 in today's standards. That's quite a little bit of money for about six people to stay at the little Bohemia lounge. But, you know, at the same time, there's a $10,000 reward out for Dillinger. So sometime he got there April 20th of 1934. And sometime after that, like the next day, Mr. Wanatka's wife contacted FBI agent Melvin Purvis in Chicago. I think what they wanted to do, they'd gotten their $500, but I think they were going for the big money, the $10,000. Remember, this is 1934. This is during the Depression. They made a big investment in 1929, built this lodge, and
they knew that they had John Dillinger in one of the rooms.
Right.
But he's also, isn't he a known killer?
Oh yeah, sure.
So I mean, that seems pretty dangerous.
It was.
He wasn't there with Ma Barker though.
He was there with Babyface Nelson.
Also another known killer.
And a couple of others that I'd never heard of. Homer Van Meter and John Hamilton and Tommy Carroll were their names. Now, when you check into them, you'll find they're all well-known roving bank robbers and parts of these gangs. They'd go from one gang to the other. They'd break apart and then get back together and with some other people and do some more bank robberies and just on the lam all the time.
Now, was one of the people there then Joey Iopa?
Well, he wasn't there yet.
Okay.
So I'm just setting it up.
There was, it seems in the discussions we had with about these era gangsters and mobsters,
yeah,
is there's really kind of a distinction between
there is
being a mobster and being in the mob and being somebody like, you know, who would be Nick Civella, you know, a mob boss,
right,
or underlings or associates, and what seems to be these 1930s mob, not mobsters, but just gangsters, just
right,
guys running around with guns, robbing banks, killing people.
Right. But, you know, the mob always has a use for people like that. And even in more modern times, but Nick Civella won't. Al Capone wouldn't go talk with these guys or work with them on anything. But at this point in the 1930s, Joey Iopa, what was he? He was small time. He was just making his bones. He was just getting in and starting his criminal career. And so he's the kind of guy who could then work with these people.
Well, it was prohibition in effect in 34, so I mean he would have been like driving trucks supposedly.
He was doing gambling things primarily. His main thing, he had a club up here in Cicero and it was helping to run the gambling. Dillinger and these kind of guys were hired guns. You could, if you needed something and you know, maybe he would go in and set up a robbery and then tell them all about it. Tell him what the score was and then get a big piece of the action. And all he had to do was set it up, because that's what mob guys do too. Is if you think about the whole crew of Goodfellas, that none of those guys were made guys. They were all either half Italian or non-Italian at all. Jimmy the Gent and Henry Hill and I can't remember the others' names, but they were big money makers but they enjoyed kind of the protection of the mob, and the mob, you know, helped them with different things but the mob got a piece of their action whenever they did something
or kick it up.
Right. Same way here. The Dillinger and them would kick a piece for some political protection and connections and hideouts and things like that to a mob guy. They would pay part of it, but you know, they would pay him for that. And the mob guy may want somebody killed someday, that, you know, he could go to Dillinger and say, hey, we need this guy off, or we need this witness terrified, or we need something done here, and you know, we need an arson done here, and you know, he'll go do it then. I mean, that's just how it works.
Well, so here we are. I mean, according to the notes I'm reading here, with a $10,000 reward on his head, John Dillinger staying at a place in Wisconsin, and the owner's wife contacts the FBI.
And Melvin Purvis. Melvin Purvis is the became famous shortly thereafter by killing Dillinger at the Biograph Theater, if you remember. But anyhow, so Purvis is a really aggressive agent. He's the head agent, I guess, in Chicago, and he gets hold of J. Edgar Hoover, and Hoover tells him to call in all the agents out of St. Paul and most of the agents out of the Chicago office and go up there. So they go up there in a convoy, and they didn't know exactly who was there, rather than they were pretty sure it was John Dillinger. Whatever can go wrong will go wrong in these deals. They didn't really sneak up and scout the place out, and they just
rallied the troops.
They just rallied the troops and it got some guns and headed out. This is partly from a book and partly from the FBI files
that you got.
There's a real detailed book on this. What they call it, the Battle of Little Bohemia Lounge, I think, or Battle of the Little Bohemia Lodge is the name of the book.
And the Little Bohemia Lodge still there?
I think it is.
Another one of these great, you talk about the app being the Kansas City mob tour, but all these connections across the country.
Well, maybe I'll get around to that one of these days. That's a lot of work and I'm not sure. But anyhow, so as agents approach the resort, there's three men that were unrelated to the gang. They're leaving. But the agents, they immediately assume that's them, and they just start shooting, and they killed one innocent guy. Well, the gang's alerted, and a real gun battle ensues. They said, the book said that this Tommy Carroll got the high ground, and he had some kind of automatic rifle. It was like a 30 caliber rifle. It wasn't a machine gun, but it was probably like a Browning BAR, but it was been altered to be fully automatic, and started firing at the agents, and they get pinned down, and Dillinger and a guy named John Hamilton and Homer Van Meter escape out the back, and they steal a Model T car at a neighboring resort. Now, it's reported in that book that the Dillinger came into the resort and found the owners of the Model T, and he said, "Now, I'm John Dillinger, and I don't want you to be afraid, and we're not going to hurt you any. We just want your car, and I'm not as bad as they have me pictured, so don't be afraid, but we got to take your car." So they take his car, and John Hamilton's been wounded at this point in time, and they head south towards Chicago, of course, and Babyface Nelson was away. I think there's a movie on this thing.
Now, so they get but wait a second. What happened to the guy, Tommy Carroll?
I think he gets killed. I kind of forgot about him because I was focusing on Dillinger.
Yeah.
I believe he got killed up there.
He's following the story.
Right. And Babyface Nelson, he drives up while the shootout's going on. He kills an FBI agent, wounds another policeman, and he escapes all by himself in a stolen car. So their women, they had a couple of women with them, their wives, and they're left there, but all the men got away. So during this time, there's a guy in Chicago, a Capone associate. At this point in time, he's known as Joey O'Brien, who is in fact Joey Iupa. Now, this is according to the FBI reports. And they ask him, how come you use the name Joey O'Brien? He said, I boxed a lot when I was real young. And he said, if I took on the name of O'Brien, that I would get more fights. If I took on an Irish name, I'd get more fights. So I used my Italian name. So that's, but he was going by Joey O'Brien a lot. And the informants claimed that some guy named Joey O'Brien, who they figured out was Joey Iupa, had been supplying some of these bank robber gangs with hideouts and machine guns. Shortly after Little Bohemia shootout, FBI informants report that Joey O'Brien meets with John Dillinger and several other people, unknown men, at Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb just a little bit west of Cicero, even due west of downtown Chicago is where Cicero is, and then Aurora is due west of that.
What do you mean, saying this is after they escape?
Right after they escape. Sometime in a short period of time, there's a guy, the FBI informants report, a guy named Joey O'Brien, who they're pretty sure is Joey Iupa, and they already have information that he's been working, supplying these gangs with guns and hideouts, and for a piece of the action, of course. And so John Hamilton's down there, and O'Brien gets an underworld doctor, Joey O'Brien supposedly brings a known underworld doctor named John Moran in to treat Hamilton, but he dies. And by then, Babyface Nelson has hooked up back up with him, and they just take Hamilton out and bury him. Nobody ever found Hamilton's body. He's just buried somewhere. He just disappeared.
And now, what about this guy, John Moran? I mean, he was actually a legitimate doctor, but...
Well, he was a real deal doctor.
There's a whole other topic there we could put down on the notes for, organized crime, doctors.
Yeah, it's just, it is. They did plastic surgery on Dillinger. I found some information about how much the doctor charged, how much they would like use acid to remove their fingerprints. Mm-hmm. I've seen all this stuff on old movies, and you never hear about this anymore, but they used to try to do this thing.
Stuff like that. But they just
really
buried
doctors
that
did that. They just buried him,
But so now at that point, was Babyface Nelson back with them?
He was back with them, and then he kind of separates out from them. This is, again, in 1934. This is March. This is April of 1934.
And Homer Van Meter,
I don't know whatever happened to him.
They don't say that.
Yeah, they don't say that. I didn't really look into that. Now, Dillinger, by July the 22nd, that summer in 1934, he was shot and killed by Melvin Purvis and other FBI agents at the Biograph Theater. You know, that's the famous story of the woman in red that set him up, that he was out on a date with. And when they came out of the theater, they knew that the guy with the woman in red would be John Dillinger. And they ended up engaging a shootout with him, and Purvis killed him and kind of became famous for that. Babyface Nelson, by November 27th in 1934, is surprised at another Wisconsin resort. He's hiding out up there, and they flee in their V8 Ford and head down into toward Chicago, and they got to Barrington, which is a far north suburb of Chicago today, and agents caught up with them. And there's kind of a well-known
We talked about this before, kind of as the ending portion of the Union Station Massacre,
right,
in which Babyface Nelson had a known associate that he traveled with.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Terrence talked about that quite a little bit. It's called the Battle of Barrington. Nelson actually killed two FBI agents in that battle, and then was end up killed himself. He was a bad dude. But back to Joey Iupa. That was kind of his. He was connected to them. That was the early, early days of Joey Iupa's mob connections. So this is 1934. This is the beginning of Joey Iupa's criminal life. He has purchased the Turf Lounge, which is a kind of a girly club and a front for gambling.
In Cicero,
Illinois, and he's connected. He's a part of the Al Capone gang. He is partners with another Capone gangster in the Taylor Corporation, or Taylor Manufacturing Company, I think is an actual name of it. And they make gaming equipment, and they seem to have a monopoly on all gaming equipment that's sold in around in the Midwest. Actually, they developed a way to with a slot machine to put slot machines in some place where you didn't have to stick a quarter in it to make it work each time. And so you gave money to the bartender, and then you somehow, the bartender was able to see whether you won or lost and would pay off or keep your money. So kind of interesting that
had a piece of equipment like that
alter this regular slot machine to where you could still have a slot machine, not make it so evident that it was a gaming device. Kind of like they did the same thing in modern times. We took a bunch of video poker machines that the mob had put in clubs all over the city at one point in time back in the 80s. But anyhow, so that's where he is. He was known as Joey O'Brien, and that's, he's going to get another nickname, and that's what we're going to talk about next time, how he got that other nickname. So having said all that, let's just wind this on down, and we will say goodnight.
Well, before we say goodnight, we got to remind people to download the Gangland Wire True Crime Stories podcast episodes. There's over 30 at ganglandwire.com. You can subscribe to the iTunes. Also follow Gary Jenkins at Jenks Law on the Twitter. And if you don't have the DVD, you can buy Gangland Wire, the DVD, the documentary that's behind the scenes of the true crime movie Casino. And buy, download the Kansas City Mob Tour app, which will give you locations across Kansas City and other locations where true crime has happened from the Kansas City mob.
This is my favorite nonprofit, First Call. First Call, if you have a problem or a relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol or any addictive behavior, make your first call to First Call, 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org, or they have a Facebook page, too. Just go to Facebook and run a search for First Call KC.
First Call, according to their website, First Call provides clinical, educational, and preventative services to individuals and families in the greater Kansas City area impacted by alcohol and drug addiction. The agency also operates a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis call hotline, which Gary gave that number, 816-361-5900.